It's Cricket All the Way, 98 Not Out.
On 98 FM and online, this is Phoenix FM.
Welcome along to 98 Not Out, Phoenix FM's weekly cricket magazine show with me, Darren Mutu. You listen to Phoenix on the 98 on the FM dial in the central Essex area via the internet, phoenixfm.com, and of course, shout at your smart speaker to play Phoenix FM. On tonight's show, we'll be digging into the archives and looking back at an interview that we had with Ed Piller, the founder of Acid Jazz Records, but also a former Essex under-14 superstar and a supporter of the Surrey Cricket Club, as well as many other things. He's a very interesting chap. We'll also be taking a look at how England are getting on in their tour in the West Indies. There's also some news from around the counties, lots of other bits and pieces, and a bit of music as well. You know the form.
Lick all the ball and the bowl of them stall. Him lick all the ball and the bowl of them stall. Him pins them so hard.
And remember, of course, if you want to take part in tonight's show, you can use the Facebook Messenger function on the 98 Not Out page, or via Twitter, or via Instagram. Or if you're old-fashioned and prefer an email, send your messages to radio@phoenixfm.com. Title your mail 98 Not Out. And it'll get through to me. Love to hear from everyone, hear what their thoughts are.
Talking in a different style. Talking in a different style. Man calls ya Thomas in a list tongue style. Man calls ya Thomas in a list tongue style. Come and meet me.
All right, lots to get through tonight. We better make a start. Of course, as always, with starting us off this week, it's a very happy birthday to South Africa's Mark Boucher. He's 47. Zahir Khan, 44. Ajit Agarkar, 46. Shikhar Dhawan, 38. Laura Marsh is 37. Jasprit Bumrah, 30. Freddie Flintoff, the legend, 46. Ravindra Jadeja, 35. Shreyas Iyer, 29. Karen Nair, 32. Peter Willie, father of David, is 74. Sean Irvine, 41. A former Australian fast bowler, Jeff Lawson, is 36. England's Anya Shrubsole, 32. Tim Payne from Australia, 39. And listeners, John Altman and Sue Keel Commons. Lots of Indian players in this week's list. Last week it was all West Indies, but lots of Indian players born this week. Happy birthday to everyone there. And remember, of course, if you want to be like John and Sue and get your names read out on the cricket birthdays list, pop me an email or send me a message via the socials. And already my phone is lighting up. Dan Hagger, regular listener, tunes in every week. Bless you, Dan. Appreciate that. You are listening in the town of Ipswich. Well done, mate. Big Essex fan is Dan. Kitman Dan, they call him, down at the Cloud County Ground. Right, let's just take a look. Well, let's start off with some news. We'll start off with what's going on with England.
Across Brentwood and Billericay, this is Phoenix FM.
Now, England's men have arrived out in the West Indies to begin a white ball tour, and it started off with a thriller in Antigua last Sunday. Looking to recover from a very disappointing World Cup campaign in India, England started off very brightly. They posted 325, which I think, if I'm correct me if I'm wrong, is a record ODI score at the Sir Vivian Richards Stadium in Antigua. It was all looking good, but in reply, the West Indies needed 106 from their last 10 overs and looked doomed to losing, but Captain Shai Hope had other ideas. He was ably assisted by Romario Shepherd. Hope smashed 109 not out from just 83 balls, and he finished the innings in style with three sixes in the last over to seal a stunning four-wicket victory. Poor old Sam Curran posted the most expensive figures ever by an England bowler in a men's ODI, 0 for 98. And Captain Joe Butler's miserable run with the bat continues. In his last 13 ODI innings, his highest score has been 43. And when you think about some of the heroics that Joss has done in the past with the bat, we should be asking the questions now. Is the captaincy weighing on him too much? Do we need to think about someone else and let Joss just get on with the batting, where he's been such a superstar in the past? The tour moves on to Barbados this weekend. There's an ODI on Saturday and a T20 on Tuesday. And if you want to follow coverage, if you've got TNT Sports, it's on there. And Talk Sport Radio. So it's not on Sky and it's not on the BBC. So TNT Sports for the telly, and for the radio, Talk Sport.
This is Phoenix 98 FM. Community radio for Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM.
I'm John Sharma, inviting you to join me here on Phoenix FM on Saturday afternoons for Phoenix Sport. The top local, national and international sports stories, plus live scores, results, reports, interviews, quiz questions and my sporting anniversaries. And lots of great music too. That's Phoenix Sport, every Saturday from 3 till 6pm here on Phoenix 98 FM.
Tune into the Sunday sessions on Phoenix FM every Sunday morning, 10 till 12, with me, Kevlar. I'll be bringing you tracks from local artists. Most of those tracks are recorded down at our open mic, which takes place every Monday at 8pm at the Essex Arms in Brentwood, right next door to Brentwood Station. Come along and just watch, or if you're a singer or songwriter, come along and sing us a song.
Sing, sing, sing.
It's me, Michelle Ward. A prawn cocktail.
I love a prawn cocktail.
I'm always rambling. What is the mayor's chain called?
Chain.
In fact, I never stopped talking. And I rubbed, basically, all of the skin off the inside of my thigh. You can answer my question of the day.
Michelle.
I think men go through the menopause from about the ages of 18 to 65. And after that, they diet. Fantastic guests and super music. What am I lacking in the diet? Humour.
Really?
Yes.
Weekdays 10 till 1.
Phoenix FM.
Make sure you catch all those great shows right here on Phoenix FM. And Mr. John Chubb, the man himself, follows me at 7 o'clock with the excellent non-league hour. And Andy Gilson of the Orient Owl fame has done it again. More and more biscuits and chockies, fattening us all up for Christmas. Well done, Mr. Gilson. Much appreciated. And I know some people at this station in particular like to fill their boots with your goodies.
Darren Mutu on Phoenix FM.
Right, let's have a bit of music. Let's go back to the 90s. This is Underworld for all of you old ravers out there. And this is Air Towel on Phoenix FM. hopefully that's got you jumping up and down and throwing all kinds of shapes, embarrassing your kids. That's Underworld and Air Towel. Right, time for our guest interview. Now, the other day I was talking to a friend of mine about the good old days, and he was talking about how he used to be a regular down at the Ilford Palais. And it reminded me of one of the guests that we talked to a couple of years back, who was also a regular down there, amongst many, many other things. So sit back, relax. This is a great chat. This is Ed Piller. From the countryside, which is very popular these days, we have with us the founder of Acid Jazz Records, and also, I'm led to believe, a very big cricket fan. So it is a very big Phoenix FM welcome to Mr. Eddie Piller. Eddie, how are you doing?
Hello, yeah, great, thanks. And look, let's get this established. When you say countryside, I'm talking Harlow. Just down the road from Brentwood, but there you go.
Oh, that's Harlow. Is that Newtown or Old Harlow? There is a difference, isn't there?
I'm actually in a place called Potter Street, but it's just on the edge of the great conurbation that has been destroyed by progressive councillors over the last 20 years. I used to be a big fan of Newtowns, but I'm not anymore. There you go. I'll try not to say "there you go" again. That's the second time in my first two sentences, so sorry about that.
So when I do the video, I'll put a counter up in the corner of the screen. How many times you say "there we go"?
Yeah, thanks.
So welcome along to Phoenix FM. Really pleased to have you on board. Just sort of thinking about things, it shocked me a little bit of how long acid jazz has been going, and the fact that, you know, for my serious interest in acid jazz was sort of early 90s. That's 30 years ago now. But you formed the label on the back of the sort of acid house sort of rave scene. Is that correct? In the late 80s?
Yep. Myself and a DJ, you probably wouldn't have heard of him. He hasn't made much of a go at it himself. But his name's Giles Peterson, and we established the label in 1987, but we didn't release the first record till 88, about March 1988. So, you know, we've been going nearly 35 years almost.
And notable acts from the sort of early-ish days, Brand New Heavies, Jamiroquai, Galliano. Was it true that you were the first label that discovered Jamiroquai or to sign Jamiroquai in those days?
Both, yeah. He came to my office, having been turned down by most of the music industry, who said that he couldn't sing and he couldn't write songs and he couldn't dance. And I think he didn't have anywhere left to go. They'd all turned him down. And within 30 seconds of him walking in, and he started singing over a Brand New Heavies instrumental. I offered him a contract there and then. And we made his first few records. But then, of course, Sony came in and stole him off us, like, which often happens, even though we had a contract. They actually said, our lawyers are bigger than yours. And, you know, there you go. Oh, I said it again.
So, yeah, I mean, you mentioned Giles Peterson. I think that was the first time I heard Jamiroquai, was when Giles had a show on Kiss FM, when Kiss FM was a very different animal to what it is today. But I remember hearing When You're Gonna Learn and the original mix of that, which sort of made me stop in my tracks when I first heard it. And I think that's quite a hard version to track down these days, for whatever reason.
Well, I don't know why, because we sold 38,000 copies of that, which, you know, which made it quite a successful record for us at the time. I think it only got to, like, number 30-odd in the charts or something. But by that time, Sony had already kind of subsumed us with their cotton wool and tried to stop us even releasing that, but there wasn't anything they could do about it, really. I mean, that I pretty much sweated blood over that. I sat in the studio with Jay and made the demos in my own studio with him, co-produced with him, but then he got ideas of grandeur and decided he wanted to record it in different studios. So, you know, we let him have his head because he was very talented. After the sixth time he tried to re-record When You're Gonna Learn, we just said, look, you know, forget it. We'll just put out the original, which is what we actually did. But I think I was involved in the first three singles, Too Young to Die and oh, I can't remember the other one, the slow one. But there was also another single which we didn't actually release called In the Sunshine, which nobody ever heard. And I found a multi-track tape of that in my archive the other day. So with a bit of luck, you might be hearing that one day. It's a bit of history.
And the Brand New Hoovies as well, from around that period.
Yeah, loads. I mean, loads more bands than that.
Yeah.
You know, D-Influence, the James Taylor Quartet, Corduroy, Mother Earth, A Man Called Adam, Left Field. I mean, you know, hundreds of bands that we found, discovered, and set up for successful careers. So, you know, but that was 35 years ago. In the last few years, we've had three or four albums in the album charts. You know, we release lots of different styles of music, not just funk and soul and jazz anymore. We release folk, reggae, done very, very well with reggae. We're currently making an album with a 93-year-old Ernest Ranglin at the moment, which,
wow.
Yeah, he can still play as well, which is great. But, you know, Ken Booth has just recorded a new single for us. We've got loads of great reggae stuff coming out.
Yeah, you so know that I do an old school reggae show on the station, Reggae Revival.
Well, we don't, you know, we bought up a couple of old Jamaican reggae catalogues back in the day, a label called Midnight Rock, which is mainly the Roots Radic backing track, but also we bought Hit Sound, which belonged to U Brown. Great little label, didn't release enough, produced a brilliant, famous lost Delroy Wilson album, which we're still looking for. But, you know, I love all kinds of music as long as it's got a bit of soul to it, you know. Don't like techno or house. Don't particularly like house anymore. I liked it when it came out, but, you know, there you go. Oh. Sorry.
Ed, can I ask you, going right back, your introduction to music actually came from your mum, wasn't it, rather than your dad? She was she ran the Small Faces fan club, didn't she? Is that right?
Well, she did. I didn't find that out until I was actually about 15 and I'd just become a mod. And my dad said, oh, you know, your mother did that. And I didn't know that. But my musical introduction came from their record collection, like most other kids at the time. Yeah. You know, so their record collection, my mum's stuff was full of great 60s mod music. And my dad's stuff was full of Tubby Hayes and, you know, the great British jazzers of the late 1950s to mid-1960s. I was very lucky with my upbringing. But then, of course, I discovered punk. And, you know, all that old people stuff was out the window. And I just wanted to embrace this new scene. You know, I was 14. And then I saw the Jam and I became a mod. It's something which has kind of stayed with me ever since.
Yes, I also discovered the Jam. About 82, I first got into it. Then they immediately split up, of course.
Yeah, December 13th.
Yeah. Then, of course, I watched Quadrophenia, so then I got into The Who, and obviously The Small Faces. Another band I wanted to ask you about, why they were not massive, but they were one of the best bands of all time, which was The Action.
Well, very similar story to The Action is that of a band that we've just released an archived compilation of called The Fleur-de-Lis. And the trouble with these two bands were, The Fleur-de-Lis were the main British signing to Atlantic Records, and The Action was signed to the same label as the Beatles with the same producer as the Beatles, Sir George Martin. And when you've got, you know, priorities like Led Zeppelin or, you know, whoever, the Beatles, your great little mod bands are not really going to get a look in. And the thing about The Action was, they never got the chance to release an album. George Martin has been quoted as saying they were the best band he ever worked with, which just goes to show you how good he thought they were when he did all the Beatles records. But the trouble is, you know, the vagaries of history can be very unkind. And music is not about talent. It's about luck and about manipulation of charts and of radio and everything else. So there were so many brilliant bands in the history of music that never got a look in because they just weren't in the right place at the right time. And I'm afraid The Action were one of them. I mean, all you got to do is listen to their archive, their back catalogue, and you can tell that they were by far the greatest modern band that ever walked. You know, and I'm from the Small Faces. I grew up knowing the Small Faces, funnily enough, even though I didn't know my mum did the fan club. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so The Action are probably my favourite band, funnily enough, so well spotted.
Yeah, sensational. Also The Eyes as well as another one. I loved that didn't make
well,
it.
Well, I met him the other day. I met the lead singer of the Ides comes to our events, the Modcast events. So that was nice.
Right. Back in 84, I was too young to go to gigs uptown. So the first ones I went to were at the Ilford Palais. And I believe that it may have been your events. Was it the old days you used to throw
out? You really were a teeny mod, weren't you?
Oh, yeah, at the Ilford Palais, yeah.
Yeah, they were mine. I started putting on those gigs because we were sick of old people, old men my age now, telling us what we should listen to and what we should like. I was just 17 when I hired out the Ilford Palais. I was too young to sign a contract for the venue, so my dad had to sign it on my behalf. It was sold out. And, you know, we had three very happy years there until the local Gansill Casuals, called the Riot Squad, they had enough of mods coming down to Ilford. So they basically, the final all day was the final all day because they, about 150 of them came down and smashed the venue up, the Ilford Palais up. And we were never allowed back, which was a real shame. 1984, that was, I think.
Yeah, that's right. Also about that time, I started going to Carnaby Street. And I used to go to see Jimmy, and I used to buy the singles, your fanzine as well.
Yeah.
Also, one of the first singles I bought was actually on your Well Suspect.
Fast Eddie,
yeah, you got it, yeah.
Well, they were from, I mean, I think their last ever gig was in Brentwood, actually, at the Hermit Club. Is that still there?
Yeah,
it's still going, yeah.
Surprised it's not luxury flats like every other venue I've ever been to. Yeah, well, I mean, it was a great time, the kind of mod scene. I was very lucky. I was a very young entrepreneur. I left school at just 15, actually, because I wanted to work in the music industry. I couldn't get a job, so I concentrated on making my fanzine a success. And we ended up selling, you know, I think by issue 16, we were selling 13,000 copies of a homemade magazine that I did in my bedroom and, you know, stapled by my nan. Funny enough, just remembering her going round a table with all the different pages, you know, like all laid out in the right order, and I would just wind her up and push her off, and off she'd go, and 6 hours later, she'd bring me, like, you know, here's 1,000, Edward, and it's like, thanks, Nan. So, yeah, it was all completely, you know, off my own back. I always worked very hard because I loved music and I wanted to do that as a career. So by the success of the fanzine, eventually, I got picked up by Stiff Records in 1984-85, and they gave me my own office and my own staff and my own label. And I was still not even, I think I was 21, 20. So, yeah. It was a very good time for me.
Yeah, and when I first started going to the gigs in London, 100 Club, we came to those bands on that label, The Prisoners and Making Time, who were massive favourites of mine at the time. Fantastic.
You'll be about 4 years younger than me, so what are you, about 53, 54?
Spot on, 53, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's, you're the right age for that. We call that the second wave of the mod revival, you know, like after the Chords and the Purple Hearts and Cigarette Fur had all split up, you know, when the Jam went, everybody thought that's the end of it. In fact, what happened then, everything got bigger. You had The Truth, you had The Untouchables, Making Time, The Prisoners, Fast Eddie, and the Moment, and all those little bands. And the scene just got bigger, because all the kids that were 10 in 1979, when the Jam were around, were suddenly, by 1984, were suddenly old enough to go to gigs and old enough to buy their first scooter. So suddenly had this enormous explosion of mods all around the country, in fact, all around the world. And we just happen to be in the right place at the right time.
Hey, do you think there's any reason for mod culture surviving in the way it's done? Because you just sort of touched on there, in the late 70s and early 80s, there were lots of different kind of groups. You mentioned the Casuals, there were New Romantics, there were Skinheads. I think at the time, sort of 60s-style rockers were trying to fall some
You had the heavy metal kids, you had rockers, Casuals, Soul Boys.
Yeah.
Rockabillys, Teds, you know, you had goths, New Romantics.
Why has all that faded away, but mods have prevailed?
Acid House. Acid House came along and destroyed everything. What was the point in making an effort dressing up if all you were going to do was go to a warehouse or a muddy field, take ecstasy and just kind of make shapes in a sweaty t-shirt? What was the point in making an effort? And of course, the thing about mods was, you know, Acid House destroyed the mod scene as well. But what Acid Jazz did was give mods a chance to get back into music by taking what, you know, Galliano always says that Acid Jazz was half mod and half casual. The casual was through Giles Peterson and the mod was through me. And then Acid House came along. We're all like, well, no one comes to our gigs anymore. What are we going to do? Oh, I know. We'll just give our style of music a different name. So by calling it Acid Jazz, it didn't have much to do with Acid House, by the way, and people started coming, and all the mods that, you know, didn't want to go to a field, and all the soul boys that preferred dancing to jazz and jazz funk gravitated around what we were doing. And I tell you what, it became bigger than Acid House, because for one thing, it broke America in a way that Acid House didn't, techno did many years later. But as you can see from all those awful films made in the late 90s, where they go in a nightclub in America and it's all banging awful techno. But the thing about Acid Jazz, because of the heavies and Jamiroquai and stuff, it broke all over the world. So for a couple of years, from about 1990 to 1993, it was the biggest scene in the world. And we sold probably 70 million records collectively with our bands and Giles's bands on Talking Loud. So it was a very, very successful reinvention of youth culture. But none of the other youth cultures survived, really, that period of Acid House. That, you know, I can't remember the last time I saw a Teddy Boy. Yeah. I don't remember the last time I saw a... It's funny, there's always lots of... There's a few skinheads around now that always say, yeah, but I wasn't one of those skinheads. I wasn't a Nazi skinhead. I was a reggae skinhead. Yeah, right, mate. How many reggae skinheads did I meet in 19... anyway, we'll leave that there.
Yeah, I don't remember those being the ones standing on my head on the playground.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. You know, my whole life was spent either fighting or running away from or chasing after boneheads, as we called them at the time. We didn't even call them skinheads. They were nothing to do with that glorious youth culture of the mid-70s, you know, dancing to rock steady with, you know, girls with feather cuts. These were shaven-headed morons who went around beating up people. And they, yeah, and I'm glad they've gone.
Yeah.
Well, that was emotional.
Let me ask you about cricket, because a little bird told me that you are into your cricket. Do you want to just tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah. The only thing, well, that's not true, actually, but the only thing I liked at school, I was going to say the only thing I was any good at, but I was actually quite good at school in general, but the only thing I enjoyed at school was cricket. I was a leg spin bowler. I had one game for Essex under 14s where that didn't bowl me. What's the point of that then? Anyway, you know what it's like. It, at that level of cricket, it's all about the regions of Essex, and you know, you have to pick two from Central Essex, two from North. So I was one of the West Essex kids that got put forward, and because the manager, I think, was based in Ilford, I didn't even get a bowl. So that was quite soul-destroying. But apart from that, I played cricket my whole life. Cricket was the kind of thing that you could do anywhere at any time. I'd go to Australia, I'd get a game, you know. I followed England around the world. When Acid Jazz was at its peak, I was lucky enough to have the money to follow England to the most bizarre places, long before the Barmy Army. And in fact, I stopped going when the Barmy Army kind of turned up, because I think they ruined, with their constant bugles and constant crap, I think they ruined the concept of going to, you know, my favourite time, even though we got absolutely hammered in the test, was going to see England play the West Indies in Guyana, in the old ground, before they built this new fancy cricket ground out of town. And it was just the best thing I ever did. There was about 25 people from England there, and most of them, I sat next to Mark Ramprakash's family for the whole game, and there were probably about 25 people from England, but the ground was completely full up. I remember Ian Salisbury was playing, because he's a leggy, and he used to give me nets, and he used to teach me cricket. But anyway, I remember he got absolutely hammered. But, well, the young kid made his debut and scored a 50 from Guyana, and I can't remember his name now. anyway, there you go. He was about 16 at the time, and he went on to be one of their best players for the rest of his career. But of course, this is now.
Oh, not Chandler Paul.
The young one.
Yeah.
Chandler Paul. Yeah, that was, I think he made his debut, and everyone's saying, you've got to watch out for this kid, he's really good. So I played a lot, and then, bizarrely, I got a phone call from Mark Webster, who you sound like, funnily enough. And you do sound like him. You've got a bit of the Webster about your voice. He was a big cricket fan. And he said, look, there's an opportunity come up. Would Acid Jazz like to sponsor Surrey? Now, at the time, in spite of being from Essex, I didn't like Essex because I didn't get to play more than one game where I was a fielder. So so I was very keen on Surrey. They had the best team at the time. So I said, well, what's the plan? And he goes, well, a mate of mine is a bowler called Kendo, Neil Kendrick. I think he was a slow bowler, and he needs a sponsor. It will cost you about 800 quid to pay for a car. So I went down, I had a meeting with a girl, and she said, well, look, we're trying to attract young people into cricket. You know, would you be interested in a bigger package? And I said, what do you mean, bigger package? Well, you know, a bigger sponsorship package. Oh, God. I just remember it. So I said, well, you know, how much? She goes, 4 grand. I said, well, what do you get? She goes, well, I'll tell you what, for 5 grand, you get the following. Your own box at the Oval. You get 4 sight boards around the sight screens, you know. You get 1 match on the wicket, Acid Jazz versus somebody else, because we had my own, Acid Jazz had a cricket team for many years, you know, we turned out regularly. We used to play at the Paddington Rec at the time. And, you know, lots of kind of relatively famous people. We used to have a Crystal Palace player open the batting for us and things like that. So it was, you know, slightly celebrity but much more relaxed kind of cricket side. You know, so this was peanuts. You can imagine how much that would cost today. It'd be £500,000.
Yeah, yeah.
Because don't forget, in those days, cricket was on television every Sunday, and Surrey were one of the main two teams, along with Middlesex, and they were always on telly. So I, you know, spoke to my partner Trevor, who was sadly murdered in America by Russian gangsters. That's another story.
Oh. Found his
headless body in Mexico. But he was another big cricket fan. And he went to Repton, which I think was quite a big cricket school, although he got expelled. Anyway, so we took this package, and I got to meet Kendo. And what they said, the reason I picked Neil Kendrick was a soul boy, and he was a big Acid Jazz fan. But, you know, when I went down for the meeting, they said, well, you can choose somebody else from, you know, maybe from the second 11, you get somebody else to sponsor as part of the package. So I phoned up my mate, who was a cricket commentator at Test Match Special, like a producer, not a commentator, and I said, anyone in the Surrey second 11 I should pick as a sponsor. And he went, well, there's this kid who's, you know, he's only, I don't think he's played for the first team, but his name's Adam Holyoake. And, you know, I've heard good things. So I picked Holyoake. Within 9 months, he was captaining England's one day side.
That's right.
So suddenly I found this Acid Jazz at the centre of Surrey's best season, you know, for many years. I'm down there, long hair and a beard, playing on the pitch with my own box. And it just, you know, we took Loaded magazine down to see Surrey Middlesex, and Phil Tuffle spent the whole afternoon in our box thinking that the game was finished, when in fact the sun came out, and then he hid under the table when Mike Gatton came in and said, has anyone seen Tufnell? He's going into bat in half an hour. And of course, he was under the table, having had a couple of pints, shall we say. I had a wonderful time with Surrey. I got to know a lot of the England players. I regularly had nets with Adam, and Adam said, if you think I'm good, you want to see my brother Ben. And something happened with Ben Holyoake, and I was never sure what it was, because I think they stopped his England career far too early. You know, he had such promise, and I think his last game was 88 not out in for England, bang at like number 8 or something, and they never picked him again. That's an approximation, by the way.
Yeah.
And I never really knew why. And I think a lot of the time around that time, Mike Atherton was really against having a separate setup for the one day side. And I think he resented Adam Holyoake coming in, being a captain with an Australian accent. And I think, you know, the powers that be, Mickey Stewart was around. You know, it was very much old guard, and they didn't like this concept of a separate one-day side. And consequently, I think after Hollyoaks' experiment, they went back to having the same captain, but it never really worked. So after a few years of having a brilliant time, I had to stop sponsoring because obviously I wasted all my money on a nightclub called the Blue Note in Hoxton. And so I stopped sponsoring, sorry. But it gave me, that's how I met Mark Butcher, you know, and that's how I met so many of the England players. And it was such a laugh. It wasn't, well, you'd be amazed at how unprofessional it was. It just seemed to be like big club cricket. You know, club cricket with brilliant players. First 11, kind of, plus and plus, you know, playing against the West Indies. For, you know, it was just a brilliant time. And I think gradually, you know, cricket realised it couldn't carry on. It had to get professional. And it did in terms of sponsorship and in terms of player preparation. So, you know, I can remember an England player on that West Indies tour, which was probably the last, it's in the early 90s, probably the last unprofessional. I can remember an England player dancing around a table with his trousers around his ankle, dancing on a table. In a bar full of, you know, about 20 Brits and about 40 West Indians, and just thinking, what the hell is going on? You know, what is that guy's going to be batting tomorrow? You know, it was just a mad time and one of the best times of my life.
You mentioned the Blue Note and Hoxton. Now, when you went down that path, Hoxton was a fairly, shall we say, not too fashionable part of London. It was all sort of bomb sites and disused warehouses and all kinds of stuff. And I've read an article saying, basically, that you were the man that basically turned it all around and is responsible for it now being achingly hip and trendy. What do you say about
that? No, it's not. It's no longer achingly hip and trendy. This is the trouble. What happened, I'll tell you exactly what happened. My dad was born 100 yards from where the Blue Note was. I worked for Stiff Records in Hoxton Square. I used to go for lunch in this club, and it went bankrupt. It was a down-at-heel, derelict jazz club set in a Victorian lunatic asylum, and it was derelict. I bought it for £200,000, you know, the freehold of a five-story nightclub, and I made a gallery, I made two recording studios, I had offices, I had a nightclub, I had a cafe, the whole kind of thing. And we were the only business. There was a taxi firm, there was a couple of independent kind of media companies, and there was the news agent didn't even have a front window. It had a grill. It was a hole in the wall. So when I bought it, my dad said, don't, son, do not. You'll have gangsters asking you for money. You know, it's a very racist area. The Hoxton was one of the last white ghettos in London at the time, and they like the Isle of Dogs, they still had BNP councillors, if you can imagine. You know, and we found that a lot of them... So basically, I spent £1 million on turning this derelict building into a nightclub. And then just before we opened, a member of the council came to me and asked me for a £10,000 cash bribe, or we wouldn't be able to open. And of course, I exposed him to his boss at the council. And because of the way Hackney Council, the corruptness of Hackney Council at the time, he didn't get fired. So from that point on, he tried to close me down. We got the license. I didn't pay the bribe. But from that point on, I was in a six-year fight to not close the club down. It took 6 months for the club to get going, and by then it was full up every single night. You know, 7 nights a week, there'd be a queue outside. It became the coolest club in the world for, you know, a few years, and it was. And I've got one little story to illustrate how cool my club was, and I'll tell it because I remembered it the other day, and I did tell it once recently, but basically, we didn't allow celebrities. We had a lot of celebrities come, and we didn't allow celebrities to go at the front of the queue. You know, you didn't have to wear, you know, no jeans, no trainers, you know, all that crap that you had in clubs in the beginning of the 90s. We didn't have any of that. If you wanted to come to our club, it didn't matter if you looked like a vicar or a tramp or you know, David Bowie. Anyway, so one night, I'm sitting in my office in the club, and the head of security's come and said, look, you know, there's a couple of people downstairs. I really think you need to let them in. Yeah, they're queuing up. I said, well, they have to queue up. That's what we do. And he said, no, you really need. So anyway, I said, they can queue up. 5 minutes later, he comes back and goes, look, you know, I'm sorry, you're going to have to come down and see him. So I go downstairs, and standing on the steps in the front of the club is Damon Hill and Barry Sheen. And I go, oh, my God, God, I'm so sorry, you've had to wait. Come in, come in. I took him through to the bar, took him up to the bar manager and said, look after these chaps. You know, Barry Sheen's one of my heroes. It would be fantastic. Anyway, I go back upstairs to be followed by the angry head of security. He goes, what are you doing? I said, what do you mean, what are you doing? He said, I came down. I said, I've let him in. He goes, not them, you idiot. Come downstairs. So I follow him angry by now. I don't like being disturbed when I'm, you know, anyway. So I get back downstairs, and there at the front, about four back from the front of the queue, is David Bowie and Imam standing in the queue. And I go, oh, them. I didn't see him. I'm really sorry. So I go to David Bowie and I say, look, mate, I'm really sorry. You know, we're quite busy tonight. Would you like to come in? He said, look, I've been queuing up for half hour. I've got absolutely no problem with queuing up. I'll be in 10 minutes. How cool is that?
Wow.
David Bowie want to jump the queue. So that's how cool it was. And I had a fabulous time. But eventually the council won. The area became gentrified. There was another nightclub open called the 333, which was a lot more down market than us, but they brought a lot of people in. And because they were paying their bribes to the council, they were allowed to open. Eventually, the council closed down the club. I owned two other bars in Hoxton Square. The council took the license away from all of my clubs, and I lost quite a lot of money. So from that point on, I had to start again, and I was quite poor. But it still gave me the best 7 years. You know, it was a wonderful nightclub. You know, all the people that started it, Goldie, Talvin Singh, Cold Cut, it was just amazing.
But was Blue Note Records associated with that, or was that something else?
No, we nicked the name, because it was jazzy.
Yeah, yeah.
Ed, is it right that I read that you're writing your autobiography?
Yes, that is right. I'm nearly finished, actually. I'll be finished by the 1st of June. But it's not my autobiography. This is weird. The publishers, who are quite a big publisher, only want me to write my autobiography up to before I started Acid Jazz. So it will be an autobiography of the mod scene, of my time on the mod scene, up to about 1985. So all the Acid Jazz stuff, the Blue Note, that'll all come in part two, apparently, according to them, anyway.
Interesting. Also, a question sent in from a mate of mine called Derek Cox. He said, how did you get to meet Martin Freeman and realise that you had the same taste in music?
See, he must have read my answer on that, because he wouldn't have asked that question otherwise. I'll tell you exactly how. We were at a gig. Paul Weller's sister, who used to be my PA at work at Acid Jazz, said, oh, have you met this guy? He's an actor. And I'd never seen The Office. I didn't know who he was, and we just got talking. And he said, look, I just want to say the album you produced by the Brand New Heavies, you know, on that track, Sphinx, did you nick that key change from the Mizell Brothers? And I went, well, why did you know that? Because he looked like a child, obviously. And he said, no, I spotted it. And I said, well, actually, yeah, you're right. We did. I produced it, but they wrote it. The difference, when you know actors before they're famous, they're your mate. But once they're famous, everybody wants to know them. So they're very suspicious and their guard's up all the time. So me and Martin are very good friends. I spoke to him only 2 days ago, fun enough.
Are you going to do
it? Very fun, I see, of your cohorts.
Well, Matt is one of my best friends as well. But me and Martin, to answer the question, me and Martin are just working on Jazz on the Corner Volume 3. Uh-huh. So that will definitely be coming out. I don't know if either of them are cricket fans. Matt Berry's father-in-law was a former manager of a Premier League football team, but I'm not allowed to tell you who it was. There you go. sorry. So we haven't really talked much about cricket. It's just been me ranting, hasn't it?
It's fine. It's fun. I think what we'll have to do is we'll have to drag you down to the studio, and you can present a show one night. And,
well, it's not far, is it, Brentwood? Let's be honest. I might even come on my scooter.
Well, there you go.
If the sun's out. Yeah, anyway, so I stopped very briefly. I'm just finishing off on cricket. I used to coached a team at Epping, and I was very proud that one of my girls ended up playing for Essex Ladies First Team. Although the trouble with ladies cricket was she got married and stopped playing. So, you know, you see them come through the ranks as a 12-year-old all the way up. You know, I was very proud of that. But I stopped playing. I had cancer about 7 or 8 years ago, and I stopped playing then. I haven't played since. With a leg spin bowler, it's like a sax player. You've got to keep doing it on a regular basis, or you lose the grip and the turn. So I don't know what it would be if I played again. But I might turn out for an old man Sunday team maybe one day, but you know, no one's asked me, so probably not.
Many thanks for joining us, Ed. Really amazing chat, and I feel that we've only just scratched the surface with a lot. We will be back in touch, and we'll get more stories out of the wonderful Mr. Ed Pillar.
Well, thanks to both of you, and take care.
The excellent Ed Pillar. Many, many stories. And yes, I'm sure there's more of those cricketing stories to come out. We'll have to get him back. And my thanks also to Andy Gardner, who joined me on that chat. Andy presents Under the Radar on Phoenix FM on Monday night. So if you like your alternative indie, and he's a big mod fan as well, so if you like that kind of thing, check out Andy's show, Under the Radar, right here on Phoenix.
This is Phoenix 98 FM.
Now, as Ed mentioned in that chat, he was the one that discovered Jamiroquai. So it's only right that we play the very first Jamiroquai track, which Ed released on the Acid Jazz label. This is Jamiroquai, and When You're Gonna Learn.
It's been going on, you know it can't go on. Been going on so long. Now it can't go on. Been going on so long. You know it can't go on. Have you heard the news today? People right across the world are allegedly well played the game. Victims of the modern world. Circumstances brought us here. Armageddon's come too near. Save our children's destiny. Consequences are so grave. Yeah, the hypocrites with all their slaves. So my friends stop the end on each other. We depend. Yeah, no. So mountain high and reverend deep.
is Phoenix 98 FM.
A very good evening to our good friend Charlie Dagnall, who's heading out to Mumbai to take part in the coverage of the England Women Against India series. It's just about to start. And the good news is that that will be covered by TNT Sports. So if you want to watch that, head to TNT, where you will be able to see all the action. Now, sticking with England Women, there's some contract news. Maya Bouchier and Danielle Gibson have been awarded their first England Women's Central contracts. Bata Bouchier is 24 and all-rounder Gibson, 22, are two of the 18 players to secure central contracts for 2023-2024. Young bowlers Mahika Gaur, 17, and Lauren Filer, 22, have been given development contracts, as has wicketkeeper Bess Heath, also 22. Catherine Skipper-Brunt is no longer on contract after her retirement, while Freya Davis has lost her deal. And news this week that the England and Wales Cricket Board, known to you and me as the ECB, has introduced an independent regulator in response to a damning report into the game earlier this year. The report published in June said that racism, sexism, classism and elitism, all the isms you want, are widespread in cricket. Now, the regulator's remit will include safeguarding anti-corruption, anti-doping and anti-discrimination. The regulator will be overseen by a new independent cricket regulatory board and ring-fenced from the rest of the ECB. I guess that needs to happen. Let's hope they get something from it. And finally, in county news, Stephen Mullaney has signed a three-year deal and notched to become a player coach. The former club captain stepped back from the role recently after 6 years in the job and will become the second 11 captain with the aim of aiding on-field development of players. We wish him well. Well, that's it for another show. Whizzed through this week. I hope you enjoyed it. Keep it locked to Phoenix. John Chubb is coming up at the top of the hour with the non-league hour. Gareth follows him at 8 with Bumper to Bumper, and then Madeline Christie's here at 10 until midnight. I'll catch you next Thursday, 6 o'clock.
Across Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM News.